we left off last time with the prayer that deals with the sacrifices. And that is where we ask God to accept the prayers and the sacrifices of the people of Israel. And then we ask for the return of the temple. I believe we explained that a prayer has a prayer also has a fulfillment of sacrifice, carries with it two fulfillments. It's a fulfillment of prayer, and it's also a fulfillment of sacrifice. And that's why we ask that it should be accepted as a sacrifice, not just as a prayer. And the reason for that is that the sacrifice is really where a person shows the recognition of God, and prayer is really the highest form of the recognition of God. So prayer and sacrifice really go together, and sacrifice is the way the Torah's idea of sacrifice is. I'm going to get to that in a moment, and how exactly sacrifice works according to halacha, which is a little bit different than most people imagine. But when we speak about sacrifice, we call it, in Hebrew, it's an institution. It's called avoda, which means worship. And the reason why it means worship is sacrifice is generically represents the idea of worship of God. And the reason for that is because in sacrifice, we're dealing with something, as Maimonides said, which is part of the religious instinct of man. And you remember that the Torah considers the religious instinct of man the most dangerous instinct, because that's where man can deviate and sink into idolatry. So the Torah makes a lot of precautions to make sure that that doesn't happen. And that's why the sacrifices were allowed in the temple and under the jurisdiction of the not only the priests, the Kohanim, who were learned scholars, but also the Sanhedrin was placed in the temple, right near to the right next to the not far from the altar, actually. The reason for that is, again, to make sure that man does not go wild with his crazy emotions and keeps everything precisely the way the Torah dictated. So when we're dealing with the sacrifice, we're dealing with religious instinct that the Torah takes and raises it to a higher level through the halachic system. And the halachic system, if a person studies, for instance, a person would study the tractates that deal with sacrifices, when you got finished with it, you wouldn't recognize what an ordinary person sees in a sacrifice. Because the sacrifice is worked out with concepts, and it's a very abstract area. So a person who really understands how the sacrifice is supposed to be performed in the temple is a person that has reached a very high conceptual and intellectualized plane, where the sacrifice is something that has many, many halachic concepts attached to it. This raises man from the primitive to the intellectual, where he reaches God through knowledge. And it takes the religious instinct and raises it to something which is which gives him a true relationship with God rather than just his own emotions. That's why, for instance, there was a major law in the Torah that states that one cannot sacrifice outside of the temple. And that was because of the danger. And if one did that, it was a major violation. It's called Chayev Koras, which means to say that he loses a part of his life. A part of his life is cut off. And the reason, again, is that the Torah recognizes the danger of things getting out of hand and falling in the hands of individuals, where people go into their own fantasies when they get involved in religious activity. So avodah is an institution, and sacrifice is an institution where the Torah takes the religious instinct and raises it to a higher level. There's one important thing that I believe I should mention, and now that it's time of Passover, I will mention it, and it's especially important. As you know, Ben Noach can do the mitzvahs, the commandments as a Seder. They can eat, for instance, leavened bread if they wish. They can't partake of that commandment voluntarily, but it is a halachic fulfillment if they do. And the important thing to remember, and this is perhaps might come as a shock, but it's something that is an important concept, and that is in Torah there is no such thing as a symbolic activity. Nothing is symbolic in Torah. The word symbolic is really idolatrous in itself. See, symbolic means that the person looks at something and something in the outer world awakens some kind of emotion in the inner world, and he's sort of entranced by the symbolism. Now, symbolism is something that activates the inner psyche and emotions of man, and there is nothing in halacha, and that I would say, especially in the area of sacrifice, if you ever read anything about primitive sacrifices, you'll always know you'll always notice that the whole activity is a very symbolic one. The animal represents has certain representations. Sometimes it represents a god, and the slaughtering of the animal has a mystical and symbolic meaning. In the Torah, we find no such thing. As a matter of fact, if you look through Leviticus, you'll see it reads very clearly and straightly, precisely, and as a code of law. It sounds almost like Maimonides' code of law. It just gives you the system exactly what must be done precisely, and there is not a trace of symbolism. The red heifer, for instance, the red heifer in the Torah, there is no symbolism, no symbolic interpretation in the Torah. As a matter of fact, the rabbis call that the Torah, the oral law calls that, and the written law also actually calls it a chok. A chok means a statute that has no explanation. And many people wonder, why is it that we have these statutes that have no explanation? And the oral law says that that's one of the things that other people mock the Torah with, that they say, well, what is the reason for this? And there is no given reason. There are people who have given very nice reasons, but the Torah itself endorses no reason. The purpose of not having a reason, God did that for a purpose. For that itself was done for a reason, and the reason is that had the meaning of the red heifer, for instance, been explained, it would become a symbolic activity, and people would think, well, this is symbolic of this, and that's symbolic of that. So therefore, the Torah omitted completely any kind of reasons and simply gave instructions as to how the activity must be done. Of course, the manner in which the activity must be done can only be understood if you study the halacha. The halacha gives the formula. I mean, it takes the written law and it gives the formula behind the written law, which becomes quite abstract and intellectual. And then the performance is one which grasps the mind, not entrances the emotions as a symbol does. And that's one principle, I would say. That's one thing which you can immediately see the uniqueness of Torah as opposed to any other religion. Any other religion always has symbolism. We have no symbols. We have, for instance, a mezuzah that you put on the door. It's not a symbol. There is, inside the mezuzah, are written the ideas, the most important ideas of the Torah concerning God and an individual's life. It's not a symbol. It's a concept. It's ideas. The matzah that we eat is a halachic activity. As a matter of fact, if a person ate the matzah and didn't even know anything about Egypt, he would fulfill the mitzvah of matzah. There is another commandment of discussing what happened in Egypt, but that's a separate commandment in itself. That's, again, not a symbol. We have reasons for the law. There are reasons for the law, as in the case of matzah, the reason why we eat matzah. But it's not a symbol. It is a halachic activity, and there is a tremendous distinction between those two concepts. The essential distinction is the symbolic performance is something that entrances the individual emotionally, captivates him emotionally. The halachic captivates him mentally, and that's where the Torah insists on worship being a mental phenomenon, and not a symbolic phenomena. The Torah itself, if you just read through the Torah, you won't find any kind of mitzvah commandment which is stated in the entire five books of Moses where symbolism is mentioned. There is one case where it approaches symbolism, and that is a sacrifice brought on Yom Kippur. There's a specific reason for that one. That's an exception. It appears symbolic in the Torah, and the reason, there's a specific reason why that is done, why that happens to be so, and perhaps I will explain that at a further date. But with the general sacrifices are not symbolic. For instance, I'll give you an example, and that's why many people, especially in the Christian community, think that there's some value in blood. Because blood has a mystical, symbolic meaning. But in last week's reading, we read about the poor man who doesn't bring an animal, but who brings a sacrifice made out of flour. And if you look in the Torah carefully and at the oral interpretation, you'll see that the Torah points out that this God, in God's eyes, this sacrifice is even better than the wealthy man's sacrifice, which may be cattle. And the reason is because this is all the poor man has, and to God this is a greater sign of recognition. There are sacrifices that don't have any animals or any blood whatsoever. Not necessary to have an animal. But, of course, in certain instances, Allah demands an animal, and there are reasons for it. There are reasons, but not symbolism. That's an important concept. So when the person comes to the temple and he brings a sacrifice, the emotions, the religious emotions, are channeled properly. They're channeled towards ideas, towards the recognition of God as the creator, and that everything belongs to him. Everything, man's ownership is not really a true ownership. That concept is and that's the concept of bringing a sacrifice. That was the concept of Cain and Abel, where they brought a sacrifice to demonstrate that there's no real ownership. Human ownership is fictitious. It's illusory. We have certain rights which we have to use in order to have society function properly, but real ownership is only God's. Same concept is in the resting, the seventh year, that the land is fallow. That's, again, to demonstrate the land should rest to God, which means that a person realizes that he doesn't have any true... The Jews are supposed to realize in Israel that their ownership of the land of Israel is not real ownership. The world belongs to God, not to man. And this concept is expressed in sacrifice, as well as the concept in certain sacrifices where the person is, of course, has sinned. Then it's supposed to bring to mind the person's mortality, and the person identifies with an animal to bring to mind the mortality of the physical. And various concepts, but no symbolism. Symbolism is against halacha, and symbolism are mutually exclusive. And I think it's a basic point, an important, very important one, and shows the differentiation between God's religion and man's religion. Now, so that's why we have with prayer. After prayer, prayer is actually considered a sort of a preamble in the Talmud to the institution of worship. Because prayer is something which brings a person's mind into its proper order in terms of man's place in the universe, his presence before God. It gives him a chance to an opportunity to bring into line his true priorities through asking for certain things, and of course it's something which improves his life as well, in that he asks God for certain benefits. So that is considered by the Talmud. Prayer and worship go hand in hand. And worship is where he channels the religious emotion. Then he's capable of worshiping God once he has the true ideas. Otherwise, his worship, of course, is worthless. Now, after that blessing, we have so those two go together: prayer and worship. Then we have the next blessing.
Rabbi.
Yes.
Question here, in relation to this idea of service and prayer for B'nai Noach and B'nai Israel, how does this affect the standing of a Jew before God, and how does it affect the non-Jew or the righteous Gentile before God? Now, based on what you've told us so far, Israel is commanded to pray based on the text of Torah and your oral tradition.
Yes.
But there is no commandment for the Ben Noach
to pray.
To pray.
Oh, let me clarify that. That's something I mentioned
yes.
once before. That
Reverend... But now, let me give you the second part. Would you like me to just hold the second part?
Okay, hold it for a second, then.
Okay.
So, the commandment to pray is, according, it's an argument between Maimonides and Nachmanides, whether there is a biblical commandment to pray. Maimonides says yes, Nachmanides says no. But they both agree, even Nachmanides agrees, that when one is in dire straits, when one is faced with untoward situations, that one is obligated to pray. Because if a person doesn't pray at that time, that means that he simply denies God, because he needs assistance at that time, and if he doesn't turn to God, then it means he denies that God has the ability to assist him. Rabbi Feinstein maintains that for the Ben Noach, this is an obligation as well. I certainly would go along with him. He is one of the greatest authorities of our century, and I certainly would go along with that view. So that would explain that would answer the question about the Ben Noach and the Ben Israel in terms of prayer. They are not very far removed. The Ben Noach and Ben Israel are very close when it comes to prayer. The only, according to Nachmanides, the only addition that you will have is rabbinical injunctions, which the Ben Noach doesn't have to abide by. According to Nachmanides, this will be a little greater, because Nachmanides maintains, according to the Torah, there's a biblical injunction to pray every day. But nevertheless, the Ben Noach certainly can pray, and if he feels that he is in a troubled situation, should and must pray. Okay.
Okay. Well, that again, the question that I'm asking in relation to that, and you said, I believe you said that Rabbi Akiva, he only prayed once a month on the Rosh Kodesh, was that correct?
Yes, that was Rabbi Judah the Prince, yeah.
Rabbi Judah the Prince, not Rabbi Akiva. He prayed on Rosh Kodesh. All right. Now, the question that I'm asking, to be specific, and you have mentioned about Pesach also, what if a Ben Noach just chooses to totally ignore Pesach?
He can, he absolutely can.
All right. He absolutely can. Okay. How does this affect, the point I'm making, and this is where we're back with this prayer, how does this affect the standing of the Ben Noach and Ben Israel before God, if he does or if he does not?
Does
pray or does not pray? Or let's just, we'll drop the prayer, let's just talk about the mitzvah. What if the Jew, the Ben Israel, what if he does not perform the mitzvahs? All right, and what if the Ben Noach does not? But then also, what if the Ben Noach does? The question is, how does this affect the relationship before God and with God of each of the
two?
Each of the two.
Okay.
All right.
Let me just explain. What is a mitzvah? As a matter of fact, the night of Passover is a celebration of two things. It's a celebration of the describing and discussing the miracles that took place through which God brought the children of Israel out of Egypt. That's one. There's another after that, which is equally important, and that is that it's a celebration of the idea of mitzvah, of receiving the concept of mitzvah. And this is found throughout the Haggadah. Most people know, they ask what's the difference between this night and every other night. Some people are familiar with that part of the Haggadah, but if you look a little further, the difference is that there are certain commandments. And it's actually a celebration of the fact that God gave man commandments. What is a commandment? A commandment is an activity which is initiated, which was created by God, through which man can attain a certain perfection. So a mitzvah is an activity that God gave man through which he can perfect himself. And we celebrate the fact that we're fortunate enough to have these vehicles of perfection. Now, perfection itself is not really the same thing as doing a mitzvah. Doing a mitzvah is a means to raise you to a higher level. When a person sits down through the Seder and he discusses the going out of Egypt, he discusses the ideas, that's a mitzvah. When his mind becomes involved with the truth of God's imminence and he realizes through his knowledge, he starts appreciating some of God's wisdom, then he's becoming closer to God. That is perfection. If a person eats the matzah is a wonderful vehicle to bring a person to perfection. But a person doesn't necessarily have to reach perfection through matzah. The Ben Noach has the option. If he feels a specific mitzvah is going to benefit him, he can do it. And of course, if he understands why it will benefit him, it will definitely bring him closer to God, because it will make him a greater, better person. The Ben Israel cannot do that. Even if a mitzvah would not be to his benefit, even if the mitzvah would be to his detriment, let's say the person would know that. And Maimonides states that even God with his infinite wisdom could not create a system that's going to be beneficial. Every mitzvah is going to be beneficial for every person in every single situation, because he says that is impossible, and God does not do the impossible, cannot do the impossible either. I'll discuss that with you. That might shock you a bit, but that's what Maimonides states clearly, and it's something which the mind understands clearly as well. But the Ben Israel has no choice, because in his doing the mitzvah, he's not just benefiting himself, he is keeping the system of Torah. And he has a personal obligation to make sure that this system is kept. And therefore, if he breaks a law, he is breaking the system. So even if in this instance it wouldn't benefit him, which I'm not saying is an actuality, I'm just saying it hypothetically, because all the mitzvahs benefit people most of the time. I'm just saying, if you could show me a rare instance, he still would have to do it, because he has a specific obligation to keep these mitzvahs. That is what is meant when it states in Exodus, and you will be to me a nation, a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation. What it means is that the going out of Egypt was an act done by God, which converted a nation which had national characteristics to a nation that has halachic characteristics, idealistic characteristics, and that's what the nation is. Now, if a Ben Israel does not keep the halacha, he is actually, what he's doing is destroying that kingdom of priests and that holy nation. He is breaking, because the nation is not supposed to be one based on nationalism. Today, of course, we have Judaism based on nationalism. For instance, a Zionistic non-religious Jew. That's a nationalistic Judaism. Torah does not recognize. Torah recognizes that, but Torah does not consider that to be the purpose of the Jew. The purpose of the Jew is not to be like other nations whose nationality is determined by characteristics like the French, the Italian, other nations. It's supposed to be determined by one thing: the commitment to the halachic system, to the Torah system of law. And the moment they break that, they're breaking their concept of nationhood. And that's why the Torah states that the Jews will never be able to have the land of Israel as long as they don't keep the mitzvot. And the reason is that what God stated in the Torah was, and that's in Leviticus as well as in Deuteronomy, and that's the curses. The curses state that either you will be a nation which keeps halacha, or if you're not, you will never be a national entity. The Jews will never be a national entity. If the Jews, as a nation, they cannot continue to exist. They won't have the land. The land won't allow them to exist in it. And that's why during the first temple, then they had the break, the exile for 70 years, to make up for the fact that they didn't keep the halacha. Before the second temple, Daniel prophesied exactly what year it's going to be destroyed. And that's because it wasn't given to them totally, because they hadn't reached the level of being a nation that is defined by its commitment to the halachic system. So the whole the concept of the Messiah is that there will be a time when the nation will be totally committed. It will not be a nationalistic entity. As a nationalistic entity, they will always suffer anti-Semitism, and they will always have problems. That's what the Torah states. The only way they could be get out of these problems is by becoming a nation that its identity is the halacha, the halachic system. That's the only time that they will be removed from problems. Otherwise, they're always going to suffer at the hands of their enemies, and they always will have enemies. Anti-Semitism is something which actually keeps the nation, because people that aren't religious Jews know that they're Jews simply because they're hated. So it's a protective device as well as a device which reminds the Jew of the fact that he could never achieve nationhood and homeland without commitment to Allah. The Jew that breaks Allah breaks the whole concept of nationhood. If he doesn't keep Passover, he's denying his whole essence and his whole identity. And certainly Passover, which is the holiday that gives the whole concept of, that's one of the mitzvot, is to discuss the going out of Egypt and where the nation became a halachic nation. And that's why the nation of Israel, by the way, that's why a ger, a person who is a convert, is considered a part of the nation just like any other Jew, because of the fact that the nation is based upon, it is identified by a certain ideology and commitment that has nothing to do with human characteristics, as other nations do. That's the uniqueness of the people of Israel when they live up to that ideal. The Ben Noach doesn't have that responsibility. He does not have to, since he is not a part of that system, he doesn't have that responsibility. He can attain perfection through the mitzvot if he chooses to. He can sometimes attain perfection through other means, not necessarily through mitzvot, depending on how he sees fit. He doesn't have that obligation of that responsibility to keep that system going. So he is in a voluntary state, whereas he can benefit from the mitzvot if he chooses to do them. That's the difference between the not keeping of Passover, for instance, not recognizing Passover. Well, and the Ben Noach can do certain mitzvot on Passover, but he cannot keep the holiday itself. As you know, I mentioned many times keeping the 39 abstentions, the day of rest. But the other things he can do, he can discuss the going out of Egypt. He could do everything else, but he cannot. He's not permitted to keep the holiday as a day of rest, halachic day of rest. That's the only thing he cannot do. But the voluntary things are fine if he, you know, and everything a person does that perfects himself brings him closer to God. Closer to God is perfection. That's the way man becomes closer to God. If a man sits down on a night of Passover and he watches television and drinks beer, he's not getting any closer to God. If he discusses ideas about the going out of Egypt and the ideas of the Torah, he is getting closer to God, and that's why he's perfecting himself. So that is the difference between the Jew and the Ben Noach, the Ben Israel and Ben Noach. If I haven't made it fully clear, just let me know. I can elaborate on it. But I hope that I've addressed the question. Okay. Now continuing on with the prayer, we're up to the next to the last blessing, and that's the one where we give thanks to God. And this is considered by the Talmud an extremely important blessing, that we thank God. And the reason is that whenever a person prays and makes a request before God, he must immediately afterwards reflect upon the fact that the good that God has done and continues to do for him in his personal life. When we thank God or when we praise God, there's one point I should make, and that is, it is not an act of the will as it would be if you thank a person. This is extremely important to realize because you're standing before God. And if you thank a person, you thank a friend, you have a reason to thank him. You want him to be aware that you appreciate what he's done for you. Perhaps you want him to continue to do things for you. that's fine with a man. But why do we thank God? After all, God knows what's in our hearts, and if we feel thankful, fine. So why do we have to thank him? He doesn't need our thanks. We don't have to do anything to encourage him to continue to assist us. So the reason is that in thanks, and same thing with praise, the reason is that in both thanks and praise, it has to be a spontaneous kind of reaction. In other words, when in the beginning of the prayer, before the person prays and he realizes that he's standing in God's presence and he reflects for a moment, as a matter of fact, the rabbis would, some of the real rabbis of old, the great sages, would spend an hour in contemplation before they would pray. And they would think about the metaphysical ideas of God and God's existence. And of course, we don't do that. We're not on that level. We don't have that knowledge. But insofar as our own conception of God as the source of the universe, when we think of that idea, we're drawn to praise. And it's a spontaneous phenomena. The same thing is true with thanks. When we thank God also, it is something spontaneous. If a person places all his requests carefully, thought out, and places his requests before God, then he has to, when he's finished with his requests, he has to realize that there is a need to recognize that God is sustaining him constantly, on a constant basis. Every cell in his body is being sustained by God's will. Everything that's, all the different activities of his life are due to God's either direct or indirect providence. Either way, it is due to God. And the fact that this prayer very beautifully states that, all our lives are in God's hands. And also it says, the miracles of every day, which means, and then the wonders that, sustain us physically in terms of our body, in terms of our environment, and infinite amount of things that we aren't even aware of. Then also some say also that the word nisecho doesn't mean miracles, but it is another word, nisionos, which means trials, that God sets before man challenges in order to improve him, so that we all have in our lives certain challenges in life, which if we come through properly, we improve our lives, we improve ourselves. The King David says in Psalms, I will praise you because you, O God, praise because you have tormented me. It's a bad word, tormented. I mean, it means that you have caused me pain, which means that things that we perceive as pain oftentimes are a challenge for us that God sets before us in order to bring us to a deeper realization of life, a deeper understanding. So we thank God for that as well. And it is a spontaneous phenomena if a person just reflects and has that realization. God doesn't need the thanks, and we don't benefit God. It's something which, if we do it, it shows how we are in tune with the reality of God's existence. And that's why we have that prayer. Now, after that prayer, that prayer, by the way, is considered the proper prayer after worship. After the worship of God, a person also, the worship and prayer is followed by the thanks. Then we have another part of the Shemon Esrei, the last blessing. But before we get to the last blessing, there really is the Birkas Kohanim, the blessing of the priests. And I'm sure you must have it in your Sidur, and that's where the priests get up before the people and they spread their fingers in a certain way, and they raise their hands, and they state, make the statement of the well-known statement of may God bless you and keep you, and those three verses. Now, this is done in Israel, by the way, every day, and it was a part of the prayer. Why it's not done outside of Israel every day is a halachic anomaly. No one can explain it. because there doesn't seem to be any reason why you shouldn't do it. This was always done in the time of the Talmud. It was always done every day. But somehow or other, at a later time, they stopped doing it. One of the reasons that the scholars give is, one scholar gives is, that in order to bless people, you have to be in the proper state of mind. And since the galut, the exile, was so difficult and upon people, and they were so tormented and dealt with so ruthlessly, that they suffered so much that they weren't in the frame of mind to offer blessing. That's a possibility. If you don't do that, it doesn't disqualify the prayer. There are certain things you don't do disqualifies the prayer. This is not one of them. But it is, you are missing this blessing of the priest. In Israel, every morning they do it. And for me, it sounds strange when I'm there, because like I'm so not used to it. But if someone, there was the Gaon of Vilna, you may have heard of him. He was really a giant of a man in terms of scholarship. And he tried to introduce doing this blessing every day outside of Israel. But he changed his mind. He was not successful at implementing that. But it's an interesting, it happens to be an interesting halachic fact. But why is this placed here? So this is based upon the Talmud states that this is based upon Leviticus 9. In Leviticus 9, it states that after Aaron offered his sacrifices on the first day of the setting up of the temple, which was the eighth day of the Miluim, I don't know exactly how to translate it in English, but it's the it was the first day of setting up of the temple. That's 9, 9:22. It says, and Aaron raised his hands to the nation, and he blessed them. And raising of the hands is the blessing of the priesthood. They raise the hands and they say those three verses. And it says, and he went down from making the chatos, the sin offering, and the burnt offering, and the peace offering. And then it says in 23 that that Moses and Aaron went to the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, and they blessed the nation, and the glory of God descended upon, appeared to the people. So after the worship, so there's the concept of blessing. Now, the reason is, but what is the blessing? It's interesting. When you take a look at the blessing itself, may God bless you and keep you, may the Lord shine His countenance upon you and give you grace, and may the Lord raise His countenance to you and give you peace. Now, the blessing, as you notice, is very vague. It's a vague kind of a blessing. Somebody asked you for a blessing, they would want to ask something more specific. Give me $1,000,000, or give me something that I know. What is this vague kind of a blessing? But it's vague for a reason. Again, because of the monotheistic idea of Torah, which means that we try to say as little as we can about God, and only what we know. What the blessing explains is, what the blessing says, when may the Lord shine His countenance upon you, what it means is it's a reference to all the good things that we received from God. If you take a look at the blessing, it explains that. Grant peace, goodness, and blessing, favor, kindness, and compassion upon us and upon all of Israel. And then it says, it goes further, bless us, O Father, all of us as one, with the light of your countenance. That's where it says, may the Lord shine His countenance upon you. For by the light of your countenance, you gave us, our God, I'm skipping the God's name, a Torah of life, and the love of kindliness, righteousness, blessing, compassion, life, and peace. So it means to say that this is referring to all those good things that emanate from God. And when there are certain times that these things emanate, like the giving of the Torah. So we say during that moment, we refer to that as God's countenance shining upon us. It means to say that at that time, there was something that we were deserving to have a relationship with God. The blessing is God's countenance shining upon us means, implies, a kind of a closeness between God and us, a relationship between God and us, but it's spelled out very metaphorically, so that we shouldn't become anthropomorphic about it. It's sort of like a metaphor, and that's what the blessing is. The blessing for man is that God should relate to him. That's what it means by shining his countenance upon him. And of course, the highest blessing is peace. Peace means when man is at peace, it means that every part of his nature is in harmony, and he's not a conflicted individual. We are conflicted people because we aren't perfected. The perfected man enjoys a kind of peace and contentment with himself, within himself, I should say, because he's in harmony. His soul is in a state of harmony, and his energies are not in conflict. That is the highest level of function, and we ask that God give us the ability to have that kind, to be on that, to have that level of function. Now, it's interesting, but the blessings of that was the blessing. Those are the blessings. The blessing comes right after the worship. In other words, after a person has succeeded in taking his religious instinct and expressing it properly, then Aaron, after he did this, the worship, so then Aaron blessed the people, because after the people were involved in the fulfillment of the sacrifices in the proper manner, then what they should look for is, due to that, they should have a proper relationship with God, and that is the blessing of the priests. Now after the blessing of the priests, we have the blessing that I just read to you, which sort of explains the blessing of the priests. But there's a little more to it, and that is that this. Why is that necessary to have this annotation? It's not just an annotation; it's actually another. It's the last of the blessings of the 19. And the reason is because we do not believe, and this is extremely important. We do not believe that the priests can bless the people. As Maimonides says, how can it be that an ignoramus who happens to be a Kohen should be blessing a righteous person who is a brilliant scholar? Doesn't make any sense. So Maimonides says, because it is not the Kohen, it's not the priest that's giving the blessing. He is echoing the words of the Torah. But the Bible states specifically, and they shall place my name upon the children of Israel, and I will bless them. That's what is stated in Numbers after the blessings are recorded. Which means to say that Kohen, the priest, doesn't really bless the people. That would be making man giving man power, and that's against the whole monotheistic idea of Torah. But the Kohen echoes the words, the statements that the Torah has prescribed. As a matter of fact, the Kohen isn't even allowed to initiate the statements himself. Someone must read the statements for him word for word, and he reads the words. Says, may God yivarechacha, which means he should bless you, and the Kohen says that. So it's done. Each word is said to the Kohen. So no one should think it's the Kohen that has the power of blessing. That's the primitive people always look for individuals, for human beings to give them blessings. That's a primitive concept. But the Torah says that the Kohen merely echoes, makes these statements, and then God says that if these statements are received in the proper way by the people, if they're in tune and their minds are in tune to the ideas and they recognize that the true benefit is a certain closeness with God, then God says, I will bless them. And that's why when the Kohen goes up and on the podium and he gives the blessing, he is not permitted to leave after the blessing. What he does is, He recites, before he leaves, he must recite a specific blessing himself. And that is, as the cantor, the one who's reciting the Shemona Esrei, as the cantor starts saying this blessing, where he's asking God to bless the people, indicating clearly that it's not the Kohen, but it's God that blesses the people, then the Kohen himself says, says a small prayer, which he says, we have done, basically, we have done what you commanded us to do, and now we ask you to look down from heaven and to bless the people of Israel, stating clearly that he is not the one that gives the blessing, but that God is the one that gives the blessing, just as the cantor who reads this blessing asks God for the blessing. He says, grant peace, goodness, blessing, favor, and kindness, and compassion upon us and upon all Israel, which means clearly that he is asking God for the to give the blessing, actually. Okay, and that is the last, with that, the Shimon Esrei is concluded. Let me see. What I would like to do is perhaps, we finished the Shimon Esrei, and I think we've gone through the main concepts, essential concepts there. What I'd like to say is, just in summing it up, I would say that the concept of prayer in Torah is that prayer is an intellectual performance. It's a performance that the mind has to be involved in to the fullest. That's why if a person drinks, he's not permitted to pray after he drinks until the effect of his of the drink is completely, the effects of the alcohol are completely removed. And that's considered a terrible thing. Why is that so? Because when a person drinks, his mind is compromised, and he cannot think as well. And we're not permitted to appear before God, present ourselves before God, if our mind is not 100% in the best condition. Now, prayer being a concept of mind differs greatly from Christianity, for instance, where you have this speaking in tongue, or I believe in the New Testament they mention something about babbling, and that concept is completely opposite to Torah. Over there, they believe prayer is something which comes from the emotional part of man, and therefore, the less intelligible they are, the more involved they are. And this in Torah is exactly the opposite. That prayer is something which is involves the mind. And if you can't formulate your ideas clearly, if you start babbling, then it indicates that you're not really in God's presence at all. In prayer itself, there is a connection between therefore between monotheism and prayer, really, because in monotheism, what we maintain is that God is a being that cannot be perceived through the physical. He cannot be perceived through the emotional. He can only be perceived through that element, the divine element given to man on the sixth day of creation. And that divine element is his mind. And so there is really a tie between the Torah's monotheism and the Torah's idea of prayer. If a person believes that he could reach God through the emotional, then he believes that God has emotions. That is not in the Torah's idea. That is not true monotheism. Monotheism is something which we say God is removed from emotions. He's removed from any physical type of attribute. And the only way we could perceive God, as much as we can perceive him, is through our mind and through the knowledge which the Torah gives us about God. In summing up prayer, I would say that there are three components to prayer. And this is something which the rabbis point out. And it's alluded to clearly in Genesis. The first component is the rabbi tells that there are three times in the Torah in Genesis where prayer is mentioned. The first is by Abraham, where it says Abraham came back to the place where he stood before God, and that's where he prayed for Sodom and Gomorrah. So the Talmud says, and the word standing means pray, and it quotes another source. So, but the Talmud, what the Talmud is trying to point out, it's the oral law is trying to point out that the first concept of prayer is the benefit that a person gains from the idea that he is in God's presence. When he does that, it takes him out of the instinctual world and puts them into a different frame of reference, the true frame of reality. So that is one attribute of prayer. There's a second attribute of prayer, and that is the oral law derives from Isaac. It says, Isaac went out to the field towards evening to speak. And the Talmud says, speaking means prayer, and it shows another source where that same word is a reference to prayer. Over there, what the oral law is trying to point out is that the second benefit that we gain from prayer is the speaking. Speaking means we order our priorities. And by praying, and especially praying in the proper way through the great scholars who formulated our prayers, and of course adding our own, but in the proper framework, we perfect ourselves through talking out our priorities. When we talk out our priorities to God, we wind up with a different set of priorities than we had before when we were just thinking about it ourselves. So that's the second concept in prayer. The second benefit is ordering our priorities. And the third benefit is, the Talmud learns that from Jacob, where it says, Vayifga b'makom, that he approached a place. But there's another meaning to that word in Hebrew, and it means to demand, to make a demand. And the Talmud says that it has that connotation, and a demand is prayer. And there we mentioned that a man has the right to make a demand before God, because of the fact that God employs his quality of kindness and mercy, his quality of mercy. And if man can come up with, if a person, for instance, is in a situation where he is liable to be destroyed, for instance, and if he comes up with an alternative plan, then God will spare that person. Just like Moses, when he prayed for the nation of Israel, he prayed for them, and what he did was, they were really deserving of destruction. So how did Moses save them? After all, God is not going to just give in because Moses believed. But the reason is because Moses gave God another alternative. He said, if I become a greater person, through you revealing to me your knowledge, then I will be a greater leader. And if I make that commitment to gain the knowledge and to lead them and to exercise my leadership to the utmost of my ability, then I will be capable of leading this nation and directing them away from the sin of the golden calf. And then he asked God, if I do that, would you spare them? So his demand that God spare them was based upon his knowledge that there is an alternative method. He had to take the initiative, though. If he did not take the initiative, the people of Israel would have been destroyed. So man in prayer is a challenge where God looks at man, and a man could be in a sad situation, but it gives him the opportunity to think and to work out another kind of possibility. If he can come up with another possibility, and it is a correct one, then God will answer his prayer and will change the given situation and adjust it to his needs, and the decree will be rescinded. But there again, it's something which man has to initiate. You see, people always think praying is like a pleading and a begging. That's a very big mistake. It's a creative process. We always have to use our minds, and God wants us to use our mind to create a new situation and to confront God with that situation and demand that that situation be actualized. So that's the third. That is the third aspect of prayer. Those are the three aspects, and they're derived directly from the verses, the three verses in Genesis, with regard to Abraham, with regard to Isaac, and with regard to Jacob. Those are important points, practically as well as philosophically. And I think if you think into it, you'll see that prayer will have a much deeper meaning once you understand what it is. And not only would it have a deeper meaning, but it's something which will bring you to greater heights. And instead of just a simple kind of pleading and begging for something that you want, which really doesn't raise a person to a very much higher level, the way the Torah and the oral law, the written law, construes prayer, it's a medium, a fantastic medium of raising a person to to a higher level. As a matter of fact, the scholars say that they quote a verse which says that we should run and know God, gain knowledge of God. Prayer is considered knowledge of God because it's a kind of knowledge. It's a knowledge of the presence of the Creator. It's a knowledge concerning our own lives where we order our priorities. It's a thinking process where we work out different possibilities. If one possibility is not working, we plan and we think and we work out different possibilities. So it's really a knowledge kind of process pertaining to ourselves. What David mentioned before, Rabbi Judah the Prince only prayed once a month. The reason is because the Talmud states that a person who is constantly involved in the higher spheres of knowledge does not have to go to this level because he's really in a higher kind of knowledge. So if a person is not such a level, as I mentioned, no scholar today would consider himself, or in the past centuries would consider himself to be on such a level. But there were scholars that were on such a level, and they did not have to pray because they're constantly involved in the world of God's knowledge and the world of Torah. That is true. And that shows, again, the idea that prayer is a form of knowledge. If you're in the higher form of knowledge, then you have no need of the lower form. But if you're not, you certainly have a need for that medium of prayer to raise you to a higher level. There is one thing that I would like to, one point I'd like to make clear. I said we mentioned God's mercy. And God's mercy and God's justice are not a contradiction. I saw that some parts of the New Testament seem to think that it's either by grace or by law, but that's not true. Both of them exist simultaneously, and there is no contradiction. What is meant by God's mercy is precisely this. As a matter of fact, prayer is called rachame, which means mercy, because when we pray to God, we are asking him to change the situation. And we say that God's, and one of the attributes of God is that, one of the attributes of God is that he doesn't change, but he is such that if man offers an alternative plan, as I mentioned before, then he will adjust for that situation.
Rabbi, you got 60 seconds.
Okay. That's what we refer to as mercy. So God is one, but he is such that he does demonstrate mercy if man uses his initiative to create a situation where it is more beneficial for him. Okay.
Okay, thank you. We appreciate it. Okay. Did that work out your hostilities?
nobody actually took it.